This is 91.3 FM KUAF in Fayetteville, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. And this is Ozarks at Large for Friday, November 29th, 2019. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. On today's special edition of the program, we'll hear highlights from last month's gathering of the groups at the Fayetteville Public Library. The annual event invites local book clubs to have lunch at the library while listening to a discussion with an author. This year's event focused on I Have the Right To, a high school survivor's story of sexual assault, justice, and hope, which was read throughout Northwest Arkansas as part of the One Book, One Community project. I moderated the discussion with the featured speakers Chessie Prout and Jen Abelson. Chessie was a 15-year-old student at a prestigious New England boarding school in 2014 when she was sexually assaulted by a popular senior at the school. Jen, an investigative journalist at the Washington Post, helped write Chessie's memoir, which follows her journey of navigating the legal system after reporting her attack and her decision to become an advocate. To begin our conversation, Jen explained how she and Chessie met.
So I was working on an investigation into sexual abuse in private schools in New England in 2016. And I was interviewing hundreds of survivors of sexual abuse. Most were adults who had suffered in silence for decades. And at the same time, we were reporting that Chessie was on her own parallel journey, going from anonymous victim to public advocate and breaking her silence. And so it was in that summer where I was doing some reporting and Chessie was coming forward because the school had threatened her anonymity. And so at that point, we had a conversation and just started to get to know each other because I had, you know, the world had yet to hear from a young survivor and speaking out about their experience.
So you reached out to her just to learn more?
I reached out to learn more. And it was very funny because her dad and her parents had reached out actually to the Spotlight team years earlier. At the time I wasn't on the team, but sort of it's like our paths came full circle.
And for people here who may not be as familiar with the Spotlight team, what is the Spotlight team?
Sure. So the Spotlight team is the investigative unit for the Boston Globe and had been around since the 70s. It was featured in a movie, Spotlight. I am not the blonde woman who was in that movie. That was Sasha Pfeiffer, who's incredible, who I worked with. And she's an amazing reporter. And so the team became famous for its coverage in early 2000s of abuse, sexual abuse in the Catholic Church, and sort of uncovered horrific widespread abuse that has ricocheted all around the world. And so that team it was such a privilege to work on the team, and they've spent and dedicated a lot of resources towards investigating sexual abuse. We've looked at the modeling industry and private schools and the Catholic Church, and so it was the most challenging reporting I've ever done, but super meaningful.
And Chessie, how did you feel about one more person reaching out? Because I think at that point you'd start having a lot of people reach out to you, good, bad, or indifferent. But especially coming from a reporter, because some of your experience with the media had not been ideal. So how did you feel when she was like, hey, how's it going? Can we talk?
I remember the first time that I heard Jen's voice on the phone. I had just come back from an anger run, a stress run that I had gone on. Probably half of it was a walk because I'm not that great of a runner. But I came home and I was stretching and pretending like I was like listening. But I was like, I'm not going to talk to any reporters. I didn't want to speak to anybody. I felt like they would twist my words or misunderstand me. But my parents were like, listen and hear, and she wants to talk to you. She wants to understand. And so I said, okay, I'll listen. And I didn't speak. But eventually, I don't even remember a time when Jen wasn't in my life. I mean, you become like my third sister and like a best friend. And I mean, obviously, our relationship had to get like this because I shared every detail of my life with you when we were writing the book. And I feel like it's incredible that Jen came into our lives because my mom was reminding me this morning when I came back to my school in Florida after leaving St. Paul's school when I was bullied out, one of our favorite authors, Sue Monk Kidd, came to my school to deliver a talk during Writers Week. And I was so excited to get to see her speak. I had just finished reading The Invention of Wings. And I asked her a question during the talk and said, how do you know when somebody's ready to tell their story? Or how do you know when a story is worth telling? And
she just said, "You'll know when you're ready, and you'll know when it's right." And afterwards, I went up and, you know, got my book signed by her. I was all nervous and excited, and she looked at me and said, "I know you're going to do great things." And that was the first day that I began thinking, I want to write my story. I want to write it all down. I want to tell it somehow. So, I mean, it's because of writers like Sue Monk Kidd and then Jen coming into my life and you know, putting my words into a cohesive kind of thing that made it all possible.
And talking about a subject like this, it's obviously difficult for you as you're reliving some of your own moments and they're yours and very personal. But for Jen, you know, in addition to writing the story, as you mentioned, you interviewed like 100 or so victims or survivors, excuse me. How did you prepare to speak to them about these tough topics?
For the, it's sort of you learn as you go in some ways. And a few of the things just generally with the other survivors you sort of learn as a reporter is to always say up front, like, that you don't have to tell me anything. Like, I'm going to ask you a lot of questions. I'm going to ask you questions that sound really invasive and personal, and you don't have to answer any of them. It's a very different form of, like, investigative journalism than what I've done with most other types of, like, when I'm talking to businesses or I'm talking to landlords or doctors. The, you know, there's just something, there's so much shame around the subject, and there has been, and sometimes I was the first person they were even telling this information to. So it was a lot about giving them the control over what they wanted to share with me and sort of mirroring the kind of the language that they would use to describe their experiences to. So, you know, some people describe like an abuse in particular terms, and so trying to use those same words back to them, and then eventually sort of as you, if things aren't clear, sort of going back to clarify to say, like, when you describe your assault as, I mean, molesting, like, what do you mean by that? You know, because unfortunately you have to, as a reporter, if you're going to be depicting certain things, you need to understand exactly what transpired. So it's a bit of a mix of sort of being empathetic, but also being clear.
And part of addressing this issue is getting people more comfortable talking about it so they're not ashamed to talk about it. Chessie, what advice would you give to a reporter or to someone who wants to tell a survivor story or wants to talk about the issue just in general?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question, because before I even decided to come forward publicly, I had multiple news media outlets had reached out to our family through our attorneys. And when I was in the summer after my junior year of high school, before I was entering senior year, I decided that I would go and meet with different news companies who were saying that they wanted to be able to tell my story the way I wanted to. But I wasn't ready for that. All I wanted to do was to tell them how I would have liked to have seen coverage of my case, or how I would have wanted to have been treated by the media. And so it was pretty incredible. I got to sit in front of some pretty big producers, and actually the president of NBC News at the time, Deborah Turnus, sat down and had a 2-hour meeting with me and my family and listened to me, you know, list off, like, after a verdict, I am not an alleged victim anymore. I am a victim or survivor, and you know, all of these things, and getting the right sentencing right in news coverage, getting the difference between jail and prison right, and, you know, all of these things, and the consideration, and, you know, not calling me a nameless, faceless victim and then lauding all of his accomplishments and all of the great things that he would have been able to do if not for me coming forward like this. And so it was, you know, being able to sit in front of these high-powered people and put a face to the nameless victim that they were trying to represent on the news was empowering to me. And that was one of the things that led me to decide to come forward and share my face and name and humanize my whole experience in the first place.
So taking that a step further, you spoke out and then later decided to go ahead and write this memoir, which we've all had the pleasure of reading. What was the process for the two of you to sit down, who at the time were basically strangers, to sit down and collaborate? Because, I mean, it's been a while since school, but group projects were not always my strong suit. But especially something like this that was so serious and sensitive, you know, how did you guys approach it?
So I was working on this book project on the side while I was still having my regular job as an investigative reporter for the Spotlight team for a few months. And during that period, I was just vacuuming up everything possible. I approached this book as like the biggest investigative project I'd ever done. And so I got all of the court records, the transcripts. I started interviewing people who had never spoken before about what had transpired, and collected everything. So by the time I got to, I took 3 months off and flew down to Florida and moved there to work with Chessy a few days before your senior prom, like 2 weeks before graduation. And and I had been in constant contact with her parents, Susan and Alex, who were very much a part of this whole journey. And so by the time I got there, I had like, it was very funny because when I moved, I had like two suitcases really, and like when I flew down, the only suitcase that like I wouldn't let go out of my sight was all the files, like all my clothes, everything else. I was like, screw it. Like if it gets lost, it gets lost. But like all of my files must stay in my sight. And so when I moved down there, like I had a really good sense of it. But then we started just like every day, we would sit down for hours and talk together. And Chessy honestly was the best source I've ever worked with because she was so unafraid to share. There was nothing was off limits. And so she gave me her diary. She gave me her phone where I could just scroll through and look through text messages. We went through her Instagram, her Spotify, so we could figure out what music she was listening to at the time. We'd look at photos to see like what was she'll talk about an app she had, and she was taking pictures all the time. And so sort of the things that are, you know, sometimes the use of social media can be really terrible when you're a teenager, and it was for Chessy in many ways because social media was used against her, but it was actually super helpful for us in terms of reconstructing events that happened. And so I would just sometimes take interviews and we'd transplant them onto the page. Just she's so eloquent and articulate that it was very easy. We'd take passages from her diary and her text messages between her and her friends and reconstruct them as dialogue. And then I'd give chapter by chapter, I'd take the first stab, and then Chessy would, we'd have Google Docs and she'd share and go through and rewrite and edit, and sort of she knew this was her story, and the most important thing was that she had control over everything. And then we would take a few chapters and then give it to her parents to read through.
So several editors, giving to the parents first and then to actual editor?
Yes, then giving to the actual editor, exactly. But her parents were amazing. Like, this was Chessy's story, and Susan's here if she wants to weigh in. But they were amazing in that they were great collaborators. Like, so for me, the most important, and for Chessy, the most important things were the facts and getting it out there. And so it was so important and so wonderful to be able to have events because the family's so close. Chessy or Alex or Susan, like almost two of them were always around at some point during events that we were reconstructing. So it was really helpful to have that.
And so did you guys have like set dates that we were going to work for this Saturday or we're going to work on it here? Or was it kind of in bursts? Did you take breaks? Like, it seems like this is heavy material that you would want to maybe pause and, you know, take a walk or something.
Well, originally, the publishers wanted us to get this out and done by fall of 2017.
That's
and
fast.
I was graduating in the spring of 2017, and that's when Jen and I both drew the line and said, no, I have to finish high school. I cannot start writing my memoir as a 17-year-old, 18-year-old in high school. And so we pushed back the deadline, so we had a great 3 months to write the book. And we started with like the 2 weeks before I graduated because that's like the internship week that my school allowed. And so my internship was working with Jen and writing the book. And
that works.
So we worked pretty much together every single day, except for sometimes when Jen was in the middle of publishing her own investigative pieces throughout the summer while writing this book with me. And so it was a lot. It was very, very heavy stuff. And I was really grateful for Jen because you went through all of the court transcripts, so I didn't have to recount exactly everything about like the most painful parts of my assault, and because those days were really, really difficult. Also, this same summer, we were moving from Florida to D.C., so as we're writing, furniture was disappearing. We had no surfaces to sit on by the end of the summer. I didn't have a bed to sleep on by the end of the summer. And, we were It was a year, a summer of transitions, and I think in that sense it was kind of great to be looking over the entirety of my life, basically from birth and living in Japan to, you know, even the day that we finished the book. The outline for the book changed as we were writing it because life was still happening while I was writing. We were writing the book, and so the ending of the book was supposed to be very happy, and you know, like I triumphantly graduated. Everything's great. Life's wonderful, but my boyfriend broke up with me graduation night.
We were gonna kill him.
Yeah.
That set the book back a few days.
But it went to show that, you know, life isn't always, it doesn't end on a high note, and the ups and downs keep on going throughout life, and you know, that's like a pretty normal low to have. And so I was kind of happy that like these normal lows were part of my life again, instead of, you know, people threatening to kill me online. And so it's like different things I was able to appreciate, and I mean, yeah, and especially having Jen there to organize it, put it together, and not make it my one sentence rambles that I had written in my diary was, I mean, I couldn't have done it without you.
It was an amazing collaboration. I can't ever imagine having such a phenomenal partner. I was really worried, like the big worry and burden I had was like, am I subjecting Chessie to more pain, to unnecessary pain? And I didn't, while I felt like it was so important for you to tell your story, like it was really on my, you know, I was very upset and worried with that, like when things would, like you had stomach aches. I mean, you had real physical pain and other pain while we were working on this. And that was like one of the ongoing tensions of like, should we keep pushing forward? Is this worth doing? And so, but I think at the end of the day, she got a puppy, so it was worth it.
Yes, tell us about the puppy.
So during the writing process, our breaks that we would take were, not only did I introduce Jen to Chipotle, but I kept on looking at cute puppies online, and looking at pictures of cute puppies turned into looking at adoption sites and looking to buy a puppy. And so when we were moving, I really, really wanted to train a service animal, or at least an emotional support animal, because my PTSD was bad, and it still is pretty bad. And like, even this morning when I was feeling not so great, I said, Mom, show me pictures of JJ, our dog. And so, I mean, he was like the best addition to our family, I believe. Sorry to my sisters. But going through the process, having that light at the end of the tunnel was really, really great for me to have. And the day that we handed in the transcript, and the day that Jen was leaving to go back to Boston after she followed us from Naples to DC, we had moved into our house in DC halfway at that point, I said, we're going to get the dog tomorrow. And I showed them the picture of JJ, and he was all the way in Pennsylvania on an Amish farm. And we drove out the next day and picked up the dog. I brought him in the car, and I immediately started scratching and sneezing. So I am also very allergic to dogs, but it all turned out great. And I mean, having that sort of love in my life, and also having the ability to say, I can take care of another life. I can not only take care of myself, but take care of another life as well, was really, really empowering, especially at a time when I didn't think that I was going to be able to make it another year or another month.
You speak so eloquently about your mental health. You have such an awareness of it. And that was one of the things I found really fascinating in the book, is you're talking about mostly about sexual assault and this stigma and this conversation that we don't have, but you're also addressing mental illness, which is another one of those topics that we're trying to shed more light on. And I was just amazed by that. And could you take us through a little bit about your journey with mental health? Because it actually started in the book. You talk about after the earthquake, how your mom had you, or your dad had you, go to a therapist to start talking about type of things, and you learned about depression and anxiety like at such a young age. What was that sort of like for you, and like your journey going forward?
Well, it used to be a family joke ever since I was very, very little. We'd be at family events and functions with a whole family, and I would somehow just find a corner, find a couch, and just curl up and just say, I'm tired. And eventually we kind of realized that I had been struggling with depression from a very young age. And some of it might have had to do with my severe gluten intolerance, which has ties to depression, which I had no idea about until I turned 12 and moved to the US and had first blood tests done to see my allergies and all that. But I was constantly kind of feeling down throughout all of my life. And then the earthquake happened and I lost like the only home. I had to leave the only home that I ever knew really and leave all my friends, leave like my love for Japan and move to the US. And that was really, really tough for me. I took it out a lot on my parents. I was so angry at my mom and dad for making us leave. I didn't believe them when they talked about like the nuclear fallout there. And like, but our school did close. And so we had to start school somewhere else. Otherwise, I would have had to repeat a grade. And so, yeah, I mean, I was struggling with a lot of feelings of hatred for, like, whatever higher power caused the earthquake to happen. And a sort of feeling of, why me? Why does this have to happen to me? And I was very selfish at 12, and I still am selfish, but I was thinking about, you know, like, why did my life have to change like this? Why did my family's life have to change like this? And obviously we were extremely lucky to be alive and be safe and be able to leave the country. But going through all of that, and even in middle school is tough. Oh my gosh. So we write about it a little bit in the book. I had lots of friends who were also struggling with mental health. And one of my best friends, who was also my boyfriend in eighth grade, his brother struggled with mental health and he tried to commit suicide. And that happened on the same day that I was accepted into St. Paul's school. And I was out of state. I was in Colorado for the Junior Olympics for my club volleyball team. And I was sick with the flu. And so everything was just a mess that day. But I had so many instances of suicide going on around me, instances of self-harm, and I tried it myself. I tried to hurt myself multiple times, and it happened again freshman year when I was at St. Paul's and feeling extremely depressed and sad and alone. And you know, I wanted to try to put the pain somewhere else, because when you have this deep emotional pain that you can't really quantify, it's like you try to externalize it, try to give the power to yourself by putting the pain somewhere else. And I realized that the way to heal that, the way to move through that, is to talk about it, to talk about it with a counselor, to talk about it with my parents, to talk about it with my sisters and my friends. And I've been extremely lucky. I'm still seeing the same therapist that I started seeing in 2011. So now it's been 8 or almost 9 years now, and she helps me through every single thing. And yeah, so finding that trusted source was really, really important for me.
What ways do you continue to practice self-care other than talking to someone?
I picked up boxing.
That's a good one.
Yeah. I kept on trying to look for self-defense classes after I was assaulted, and because I was trying to break out of that mindset of freezing. And instead, I said, maybe I'll try self-offense. So I decided to fight, and so I love boxing. I also love watching TV. Oh, my God, too much TV.
It's so easy with Netflix.
So easy. And after we finished the book, I bought myself a present. I got Hulu with no ads. So.
Oh.
That was dangerous. That is dangerous. Plus the HBO Plus subscription. So I really spoiled myself. And luckily now I'm taking some film classes in college, so I can kind of use that as that's my homework. But it's for me, TV is a great way to just escape. Mm-hmm. And my therapist does remind me that escaping too much into TV is avoiding your problems, so don't do that. But I also have a great appreciation for nature and being out in nature and, you know, being around my family. So I try to spend as much time around people that I love and people who care about me and who I care about as possible.
And Jen, as someone who covers some of these more serious topics, I think something that people don't think about as well is self-care for the reporter, or for the family that's involved. How do you as a reporter practice self-care when you're, you know, diving into these worlds for weeks, months at a time?
Yeah, I did. Every day I would walk and do yoga. Like, that was my way to just sort of breathe and get through it. It is very challenging, and I appreciate you asking that question. And I remember I went to an investigative conference a few years ago where the reporters who wrote the what's now the Netflix episode, Unbelievable, they were speaking, and they were two men who talked about writing that story. And I really appreciated that one of the men said it was such a huge burden and it was so difficult to have this story and work through it that he ended up starting to see a counselor to talk about it. And it was so meaningful because people don't enough talk about the toll that these kinds of difficult issues take. I've had talked to reporters who covered Ferguson and who've been abroad, and I think newsrooms can really do a better job at helping to support employees after going through some of these like traumatic events. And so I would talk to my friends a lot as we were reporting this, and to be like bounce off, not just like sharing chapters, but also like, you know, seeking support from them and making sure that we were doing the right thing here, and that I was besides Chessie's health, her physical, mental, emotional health, I was also just concerned about, like, how could I do justice to this story? I thought it was so important, and I didn't know if I had the confidence to be able to do it. And so, I think it's so important to be able to do massages. We both like massages, too. and eating.
<food. laughs>
But I will say, just to circle back on the mental health, like, it was really, I always sort of bring this up if I can at talks, but one of the first days I was at Chessie's house, I was there first with her mom, and she had not come back from school. And so when Chessie had gone to a therapy session, I think after school, and then she like barged into the living room and was like, three of the themes that I want to make sure I want to tackle. And one of them was, I want to talk about mental health. I want to talk about my struggles with depression and anxiety and self-harm. And I had known about these issues in her life because I'd read her diary. We hadn't talked about them yet, but I didn't know if they were going to have a place in the book. Like, you can talk about her journey without mentioning that, those pieces. And it's very, also there's, like you were saying, there's a lot of shame around those issues. And so, but she was adamant that that was really important because of her view that, like, she wanted people to know that there is no perfect victim. And that if you just look at Chessie, you're like, oh, she's a beautiful, young, smart white woman, and you don't necessarily know the interior of what someone's thinking and feeling and their struggles. And so, I did worry though, like how some people might receive it. But I think that, like you mentioned, you're so honest about it. And it's something that there's so many people that struggle with it, that it's, even if you're not a survivor, there are so many people who've struggled with mental health or self-harm or any of these issues, and they can relate to the book in that way. And it's touched their lives. And we've heard from people like that too.
Part of having good mental health is having that good support system. And for you, Chessie, it seems like your family was very supportive. One of the things that stood out to me was the comment you made about your sister telling you that it's not your fault and how important that was to you. Did you know at the time just how important that was, or did it take you a while to believe it? Because I think oftentimes when I've spoken with survivors, there is that initial blaming yourself, I could have done something different, what did I do wrong, sort of thing.
Definitely. I don't think I knew the weight of her words until I met with more survivors and like heard from professionals who said that it is proven that the first words that you say to a survivor will impact the way that they decide to move forward, extremely impact their decisions. And I think I did take for granted the support that I had from my family and my sisters a little bit, just because I was so used to being supported and being, you know, understood and listened to by my family members. But, you know, my sister, that was the first thing she said to me. But, you know, later on, I found out that she told me that, you know, she was really angry at me. She was angry at me for going. She did blame me a little bit for, you know, what had happened. And, you know, so it is an education that happens for every member of a family to go through a sexual assault. There are so many things that we have to re-educate ourselves about consent and about respect and about the kind of mental transformation that goes on when you're faced with these fight or flight or freeze situations. And so it's been really interesting to go through this entire process with my family. And part of the reason why, again, I wanted to write it all down and get my story out there was because while we were waiting for what we thought was going to be plea deal after plea deal after plea deal, and then turned into a trial. I wasn't allowed to speak to my family. I wasn't allowed to tell them what happened. I wasn't allowed to explain to them why I was feeling the way I was feeling, why certain things triggered me, because my mom was a witness. They were going to call my sister as a witness. And the detective told me that to maintain the integrity of the investigation, I shouldn't talk about the matters of the case with anybody except for my therapist. And so once the spigot got turned on, once I testified in the trial, once I started talking, I could not stop. I felt so liberated by being able to speak and be listened to in a place that mattered, in a court of law, that I just wanted to keep on going. I wanted to keep on talking until people understood what it was like. And I realized that, you know, putting it into words is one of the best ways that I could do that and have it not be as taxing on me in the future. Sometimes when I speak around the country, I feel like my value lies in the terrible thing that was done to me. And so it is a little bit difficult to go and speak places about these really hard things that I'm trying to heal from, trying to move on from, but also try to be as, you know, accurate and as, you know, in there as possible to get people to understand stuff. But I feel like I did that in the book, and that was part of the way of me being able to move on, being able to go to college, and now I'm a sophomore in college, and be able to focus on other things that I feel like I want to do.
And some of the stuff you're focusing on is advocacy, as we've touched on. One of the things that you acknowledged in the book is your privilege. You know, how, yes, you have Japanese heritage, but you are basically a straight white woman, and you were afforded a lot of opportunities that other people in your situation that may be of color or, you know, lesser, a different socioeconomic status might not have. In your advocacy work, have you spoken to some of those survivors, and what stories have they shared in the sense of struggles that they had that maybe you didn't go through because of your different statuses?
Definitely, yes. And it is heartbreaking and very frustrating to hear these stories because there are so many systemic issues and blockades and barriers in place that prevent so many people from reporting, whether it be immigration status, whether it be, you know, family not supporting and then kicking them out of the family and their home and school if they come forward. And when I speak to these people, when they talk to me, when they tell me their story, I listen, I, you know, try to remember it as best as I can, and just offer my support and love and belief. And that's been all I can do so far as somebody who's not a trained professional in victim advocacy, somebody who's not a lawyer yet, somebody who doesn't have much power when it comes to that kind of stuff, except for the power of love that I can give to these people. But one of the most important things that I've found in listening to people tell their stories to me is having the professionals on hand. So at schools, when we did the book tour, there were social workers at schools who were there ready to receive the kids and to listen to them and help them in moving forward, help them find a counselor or help them, you know, take action if they wanted to. But that's one of the most amazing things about I Have the Right To, is that it doesn't have to just be about sexual assault. It's one of the most amazing parts of the book tour was going to this school in, I think it was Kansas City, and having these students, you know, claim their rights, saying, I have the right to dream, I have the right to my education, and, you know, claiming their rights as human beings and to be treated with humanity. I think that is the basic of what I wanted with I Have the Right To.
And Jen, for you, kind of the same question. In interviewing survivors, what challenges did they express to you?
I mean, I think it's similar. It's fear of, you know, the shame of their family finding out, of, you know, their ability to get jobs or keep jobs. I did a lot around, you know, sometimes it's not even just the victims. It's their, I did prefer our investigation for the Spotlight team. We talked about teachers and staffers who spoke up and were retaliated against for calling out bad behavior and sexual misconduct and lost their jobs over it in boarding schools and day schools in New England. And so, you know, there's just so much to lose by speaking out. Chessie talks a lot about how it's not the easy thing. People would say it was the easy thing, and there's nothing to be gained personally by you know, sharing your story necessarily. It exposes you to, in terms of it exposes you to people who are going to criticize you and call you out. I think we're seeing, obviously, the conversation change a bit in terms of the support that's out there, but... I mean, we had a really poignant moment yesterday. There was a young woman who wasn't from this country, who was of a different faith, where and it involved a family member. And she just said to, and it was she wrote it down, her experience on in a poem. And to her, that was like an enormous step. And to hear Chessie speak to her, she said to her yesterday, was like, just gives her the strength to keep moving forward. And so, like, witnessing those kinds of moments on this journey together with her have just been amazing.
In dealing with such a serious subject, and specifically in this case, finding out that it's not a one-off. It, you know, at St. Paul's it was systemic, and for you, all the New England schools that you talked to, definitely problematic in that area. How do you stay positive, or how do you stay motivated to keep doing your work, and how do you find a way to trust people and believe that not everybody's bad?
I'll let you take that one.
Okay. You can both answer.
It's taken me a long time to trust and make new friends, just because I've been betrayed so much over the last couple of years. I mean, going through this, we found out who our true friends were. And even then, people who were my best friends through the process turned their backs on me and retaliated against my family and me. And I don't keep in touch with any people really anymore from that area because of the animosity and the kind of divide that was formed by the school between me and my family and the institution. They started this hashtag SPSFam when all this stuff was going on. And when one of my best friends posted on Instagram about it, and I said to her, don't you realize what this means? This is, you're standing up against me and my family and what we're saying, that this, what's going on. And she said, oh my gosh, I didn't even imagine that it could be taken that way. And I said, well, why do you think they're launching a social media campaign supporting the school when I'm trying to come forward and say that there's been a history of sexual abuse here and something's wrong, something needs to change. And so it has been really frustrating, but I mean, throughout this process, I've been able to meet so many wonderful, wonderful people who have been fighting for this cause for the last like 40 years. And to be able to meet these people and hear their stories and connect with them and see how they've grown, see how they've met their partners and had children and, you know, continued to do the work, but also continue to take care of themselves, has been inspiring for me. So all I know is that I'm going to keep on bringing this topic into everything that I do, no matter what I do. And I have trouble using social media. I'm not a big, you know, like, I can't really do that sort of impersonal kind of stuff. I love meeting people in person, and I love helping the people that are directly around me. But so that's what I'm trying to do. I raise my hand in any room that I'm in and situation that I'm in, and try to make it obvious to people that you can come to me if you need any guidance or help or just want to talk. And it's been pretty great.
Jen?
I just think that it's, you know, as journalists, and we've seen the ongoing coverage of these issues, and I think it's important for newspapers to continue that commitment. I think sometimes there are questions, not necessarily, not at the institution I'm at, but like other institutions sometimes worry about like reader fatigue. Well, oh, you got another Me Too story, you have another. But I think that there, you just have to cover it as it, like it's any other issue, and that I think that it's important to keep shining a light on that until you get institutions and people in positions of power to change and to not allow sort of, you know, situations like what happened to Chessie to continue on, whatever sector it is in. And I haven't, the investigations I've been doing lately are not in the area of sexual assault, but there's plenty of reporters out there who are covering that, and I hope it will continue to be that way.
So I've done a lot of the talking. We're going to open it up to questions for a little bit if anyone's interested. If you want to raise your hand, I can bring the microphone around. We'll do that.
Hi, I'm Darcy. Thanks for being here. I'm curious, Chessie, specifically for you, how you prepare to go around and talk in a room like this or at the university, because you've told your story, and even in the story you talk about the positive support that you've gotten, and yet it's a very personal and hard thing. And so I'm just curious how you prepare yourself to talk about, to come and talk to us.
I sleep, especially when I love taking airplane flights because I just knock out the second I sit down. So sleep has definitely been an important part of my healing. And I forget where it's been said, but somebody told me that after a traumatic event, like the one that happened to me, you need 72 hours of straight rest. And I didn't get that. And so my brain has been kind of on like this different pace for a while. And so I need a lot of rest to be able to feel sane. But food, we had a great Italian dinner last night. It was my 21st birthday yesterday. So I had a nice glass of red wine as well. But I mean, yeah, again, like looking at pictures of my dog, and it does take a couple days for me to come down from this and remember that I'm not 15 anymore. I'm 21 years old. I'm an adult. I'm strong. I am fierce. I'm not going to freeze ever again. I have techniques that when I'm talking and when I'm doing these things, I have to move my toes. I have to move my legs. Otherwise, you know, when I talk about this kind of stuff, my body does kind of freeze again. And so I have to practice, you know, trying to be active. And so it's a constant, I'm constantly learning how to keep on doing this kind of stuff while moving on in my timeline. Thank you.
Chessie, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the culture that you found now that you're in college. I think in the book you were going to be starting Barnard, is that right?
Yes.
I went to an all-women's college, and there was definitely... Some of what you described in the book sounded very familiar in terms of the culture of some of these institutions. And I was just curious what you've encountered since then.
Well, that's one of the reasons why I chose an all-women's college, especially in New York City. First of all, my grandmother and my aunts and uncles all live about 10 blocks away across the park. So I have that anchor of my family. And I didn't want to be in another closed-off institution that, you know, that's the be-all, end-all. That's the only place where you can... you know, be a part of that kind of culture. And so I really wanted to choose a place where I could be, you know, I could kind of blend in and kind of disappear. But Barnard being as great as it is, it's not without its problems at all. Especially being affiliated with Columbia University, there are so many issues there. And there are so many issues within the Title IX offices there at Columbia and between Barnard's Title IX. As well, because cases that happen between, if the perpetrator is a Columbia student, they go through the Columbia Title IX processes, which have less protections for the survivors than the Barnard Title IX. And so I try to stay up with this group called No Red Tape at Columbia. Again, it is like a little re-triggering to constantly, you know, like be meeting with them and talking about these things, because a lot of the people in the group too are going through their own cases at the school right now. And so it's really tough. But, you know, I have always said that if you love a place, if you love an institution, if you appreciate an institution, you should want to make it better. So I appreciate what Barnard does in bringing the intersectionality of, you know, feminist theory and all of that into every single class that I'm in. But I also understand that there are issues that, like, we still need to address. But I think the administration there is doing a really good job of addressing problems. And they do hold a lot of, like, roundtable discussions for students with the president of the school. And, I think I can... I can easily remove myself, which is something that I was looking for, and just go hang out with my grandma and eat her Japanese food. And, you know, so that's really nice. Yeah.
Thank you very much. I'm just a visitor here for a few days. I come from Egypt. That's a very long way. Mm-hmm. I loved every word that I heard today, whether from a journalistic point of view or from you, Chessie. I'm a journalist myself. And I have to say that we do have a problem in Egypt regarding the how women are treated in general, and especially when it comes to sexual abuse. Harassment is a big problem, and even most of the blame is laid on the women themselves, the way they dress, the way they talk, and so on. So it's very, enriching for me, and very beneficial. I will sure buy the book, and I just want to say bravo. I loved every word. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
I was just asking what advice you have for people that want to bring awareness or educate others on the big issues that surround sexual assault and the rape culture that we live in today.
Absolutely. I think it's really important to do research. I was so surprised to find out how many groups there are around the country that are doing work to bring awareness to sexual assault and rape culture and how to create a consent culture instead. And so you've got to search for it. It's hard. But because a lot of these groups are nonprofits who, rely on grant money or people's donations to actually get these programs up and running. But one organization that I did a lot of work with and who actually helped me launch the Eye of the Right To project in the first place was PAVE, Promoting Awareness, Victim Empowerment. And they have high school curriculum for health classes that I actually went in and did. I taught a couple of health classes with their healthy relationship and consent curriculum. And they also do a lot of things with sports teams, especially men's sports teams in high schools and middle schools, where they can set up tables at lunchtime and, bring in these consent is bracelets and these little pamphlets that they come with that, helps people describe what consent means to them. And little stuff like that is really important. And to continue our work going forward, my mom and I started our own nonprofit last year called Eye of the Right To. And our goal is to bring this consent education to every single middle and high school in the U.S. and eventually internationally too, because I grew up going to international schools. And for now, my mom is doing most of the heavy lifting because I'm doing a lot of writing and reading at school. But she goes around to schools in D.C. and speaks to students and parents about how to bring the conversation of consent into the house and into the classroom too. So, yeah, but there are a lot of local resources that are really great. I know that the Northwest Arkansas Center for Sexual Assault was at a huge representative was at our event last night, who they do great things as well.
So in your book, your parents obviously supported mental health, like with sending you to counseling at a young age. How do you think you promote that in adolescence and high school, elementary, as kids are going through, or when you're going through hard things, whether it's sexual assault, divorce, just whatever, how do you promote that?
I think it's really, really hard. I've been trying to get my older sister to consider therapy for a long time now. And every time I bring it up, she's like, stop jamming it down my throat. I'll do it when I'm ready. I just keep on reminding her and telling her that, I had a great session the other day and it's been incredible for me to have somebody who's removed from my life to talk to me. And we did a lot of family sessions in Naples when we were there. And I feel like people will get there at their own time, but letting them know that there's an option, letting them know that there's a counselor available, a social worker available, or a therapist that you can be sent to. I know that it's played a huge role in my life and me becoming who I am today. So, yeah.
I think Chessie's mom, too, wanted to weigh in on.
Yeah.
Of course.
Be happy to.
Welcome, Susan.
I'm just putting I have the right to hat on now. So if any of you have children or grandchildren that are struggling, I would just offer this advice. We've had a huge learning journey, huge curve. But I grew up with adverse childhood circumstances, and they're called ACEs. And there's actually a website now, ACEs Connection for Parents, that you can do a checklist. And if you check any of the boxes, I think there are 10. It could be loss of a parent. It could be illness. It could be sexual assault. It could be alcoholism. It could be a number of things. If you check several of those boxes, you have a more likelihood for illness later in your life. And that's real. It's serious. Disease in our body comes from not being able to give voice to our pain and our hurt. So, you know, having been the child of an alcoholic, I said, I am not going to let Chessie suffer in silence. And so you build your village. The people we thought would stand by us didn't, but we found other people. So whether it's your child's school nurse or another relative or a friend, or if it's you, maybe you see a child struggling, I would just encourage you to reach out, because, you know, my 13-year-old now is very different from Chessie. She wants nothing to do with me or hear what I have to say, even though I've been a mother for 24 years. And so my 13-year-old, I said, you get to talk to someone who's not me. And that's the carrot for her. So I found a very young woman who she loves to talk to. And my youngest daughter has serious health issues. So I would just say to any parents who are struggling with your children, don't give up. Keep trying to find someone that your child might be willing to talk to, and or find a community of mothers who have children you mutually want to support. I mean, I think it's fabulous you're here as a book group. Book groups are amazing places to get ideas going. I think if you have teenage children, it'd be great to get a group of mothers with teenage children or grandmothers with teenage children, because we all need support in supporting our kids. So that's just my two cents. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Thank you for sharing. Anybody else? Okay. Well, I've got one more last question for both of you. What's next, either in terms of projects, initiatives, goals? College Chess next week.
So I moved this year from Boston after being at the Globe for 17 years to Washington, D.C., where I work for the Washington Post now. And so it's been an amazing journey, and I feel very lucky to be now Chessie's family is like my family. And so I have wonderful support there. And so I'm just really excited to be building my life there and continuing investigative work and watching this one over here and seeing what she does.
Yeah, I'm planning on finishing my two exams in the next couple of weeks and then going home for Thanksgiving and playing with my dog.
I like those goals.
Yeah. But someday I do want to do work in criminal justice reform, in reforming the system, reforming how courtrooms look, reforming how victims are treated in courtrooms, how cases are dealt with, because it's the system needs a lot of work. And there are so many different systems in our country that need a lot of override, maybe. But I'm studying and I'm learning and I'm trying to learn how best I can do that. So someday.
Well, we will keep checking in on you, Chessie and Jen. Thank you so much for your time today. We really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you so much.
That was Chessie Prout and Jen Abelson, authors of I Have the Right To, a high school survivor's story of sexual assault, justice, and hope, which was read throughout Northwest Arkansas as part of the One Book, One Community project. I moderated a discussion with them at the Fayetteville Public Library last month as part of the library's annual gathering of the groups. Special thanks to Josue for monitoring the audio and recording the event for us. Thanks to other library staff for the invitation and for being gracious hosts, as always. And thank you to Chessie, her mom, and Jen for participating in the event and sharing their stories with us. You can find out more about Chessie's advocacy work at ihavetherighttoo.org. Thanks also to the local book clubs who were so engaged and participated in the discussion. I was so honored and grateful to have been able to be part of this wonderful event, and I look forward to hearing about what's planned for next year. Ozarks at Large will return to the public library for another live event Wednesday, December 4th. Our annual Christmas show begins at 6:30 with musical performances by Dandelion Heart, John Henry, and the St. Paul's Episcopal Church Children's Choir. Becca Martin Brown from the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette will also be reading Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. The event is free, so we'd love to see you, but if you can't make it, no worries. We'll air portions of the show on the Christmas Eve edition of Ozarks at Large. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Thanks so much for listening. If you want to listen to this special edition of the program again, you can find it and other past episodes on our website, ozarksatlarge.com. We'll be back on the air Sunday morning at 9 with Weekend Ozarks at Large, and be sure to tune in Monday at noon or 7 for a brand new edition of the program. Thanks again for listening, and enjoy the rest of your holiday weekend.